Ladies and gentlemen, can I welcome you all to this, the first of the director's lectures. I'm Fred Halliday from the Department of International Relations, and it's a great honor that the director has chosen to give his first lecture on an international subject. As somebody who's been at the school for nearly 20 years, I want to say what enormous pleasure and stimulation it is to work here with Tony Giddens. We're divided up into different departments, 17 departments, often very narrowly focused. And one of the things Tony has done is to promote meetings of this kind and debate throughout the school of a truly interdisciplinary character to create a common culture of the social sciences. And one of the things he's particularly worked on for many years, because he's a close student of Emil Durkheim, is the relationship of structure to agency, of those things that, you know, where you can't change about society and those things you can. Now, he doesn't like me saying this, but I'm a great believer. I mean, some of my best friends are structures, I hasten to add. The seasons, the academic year, the norms of liberal society, but agency matters as well. And he is an embodiment, despite his theoretical dispositions, of the importance of agency, and in three respects. First of all, he believes in education. Education matters, and what you do with your education and what we do with our teaching matters, the kind of world we're creating and the kind of challenges we face, and that's why we're here. Secondly, leadership matters. If you're in an institution which hasn't got good leadership, you know it. And if you're in one which has got leadership, you know it. And I can say this is an institution which has leadership. The third is, I once took him to Kuwait, and he handed out his CV, in which, among other things, it said that he was a supporter of Tottenham Hotspur. And the first question to the audience was about the World Trade Organization, but the second was about Spurs and Arsenal, and the rest of the time in Kuwait, that's what they wanted to know about. And there couldn't be a better example of the relationship between structure with its rules and agency, the football players on the field, of the tension between these two things. So without further ado, for the first of these lectures, and the second one will be next week, I give you our director, Tony Giddens. Tony, you're on.
Well, thanks very much, Fred. And I have to say, in a slight mutual admiration society, that Fred is one of the major intellectual influences in the LSE, deservedly so. He's one of our greatest experts on international relations. He's going to interrogate me a bit towards the end, and we'll have a few minutes for at least one or two questions from the audience. So I wrote with some trepidation about what he's going to say. But he's much more important to the LSE than I am, honestly. So, well, anyway, we're quite a good double act, I hope. Can I first of all welcome everyone here, and especially welcome new students to the LSE who've just come this academic year. I was talking to one or two people beforehand who have just come this academic year. I hope you find the LSE as intellectually stimulating as I do, and I hope that you will participate in the diversity of visiting and public lectures which the LSE offers. It is, I think, the best intellectual environment around, certainly in social science type subjects. I'll be giving five lectures in this course, three this term and two next term. Slightly contrary to what Fred said, they're all about the future of world institutions. They're all about the future of some of the major institutions that influence our lives. Today I'm going to talk about the general backdrop to what's transforming world society. In the next lecture, I'm going to talk about the future of the nation state within the global arena. In the third one, I'm going to talk about global inequality, what we know about it, what causes it, and what kinds of remedies we can set up to counter it. And then I'll be giving two further lectures on the future of the family, global changes in the family. It's just as important as the big institutions, I think, and the future of democracy. Final lecture in the course some way through the second term. So I'll be doing three in successive Wednesdays at this time, this term. And I hope those of you who come this time will also come back to the other lectures too. There is a reading list for these lectures if you're interested, and that is posted on the LSE website, or certainly should be posted on there by now. If it isn't on there, perhaps someone would let me know. It's a fairly extensive reading list if anyone wants to consult the sorts of things that I think could fill in the backdrop of what I'm talking about. Well, what I'm talking about in this first discussion today is essentially the state of world order, how we've got to where we are today, and what the likely prospects for the future of global society are. That's pretty impossible when broaching this topic not to start with the events of September 11, since they've introduced a major new factor into the structure of not only our particular societies, but the world system as a whole. Now, everyone, I think, will have read newspaper accounts saying that after the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington, after the events of September 11, well, the world will never be the same again. Well, will the world never be the same again? I think there are two somewhat contrasting answers that one can give to this question. The world will not be the same again, I think, for anyone living in the United States, because the sort of security, the kind of isolation that the massive power of the United States gave it from world events, that kind of security, that kind of separation has probably gone forever, certainly gone for the rest of this century. The kind of psychological feeling almost of invulnerability which many people in the US have had, I think, has gone and will not return, and certainly not return in the foreseeable future. Something new has happened here. And that something new, however, is plainly not just a matter of what happened in the United States. This is a global event, if ever there was a global event, and indeed designed by its perpetrators, I think, as a global event, something I'll come back to a bit later. We don't know as yet what its consequences will be, because we're only at the beginning game of all this, not at the end game of all this, so far as the rest of the countries in the world, and indeed the United States itself, are concerned. We don't know if it marks a major shift in patterns of violent confrontation. It could be that what happened signals something for the century in which all of you will live out most of your lives. It might signal confrontations no longer primarily between nations directly, but between non-nation state actors working in networks across the world, promoting various forms of violence to pursue various kinds of causes. It might mark a major transition. We don't as yet, I think, know. In the United States, what it's likely to signal, I think, is something more contained. It's likely to mean that those of you who are from the US, or anyone who lives in the US, likely to have to experience the kind of fairly continuous low-grade terrorist activity that we've experienced in the UK, and indeed many other countries have experienced over the past several decades. Not a repeat of, well, we hope not a repeat of the kind of massive event that happened, but probably many more minor instances of attack will happen, as has happened here at the hands of various military organizations in the UK over a considerable period. So there are important senses in which the world probably will never be the same again, and by the world there you mean the world. You don't just mean the United States. There might be a major shift in the kind of patterns of violence which we'll see over the next few decades. But I think the second answer is, as it were, the opposite answer, and in a way that's a more powerful answer. That is, there are many respects in which the world will be the same as before, and there are again two major factors in this. One is that simply after an event of such magnitude, at some point normalcy resumes. At some point the kind of psychological feelings of security that people must have in relation to a risky world return. And I compare that normalcy to what happens, if you'll forgive a somewhat trite analogy, what happens when you drive a car and you see a major traffic accident. Some people here must drive cars. Well, if you pass by an accident where you see people dead by the side of the road, what do? You drive more slowly for quite a while. The reason for that is you see all the risks that you're facing that normally, psychologically, you block off and have to block off as a driver. Well, we've suddenly seen the diversity of risks which any society can be subject to, and there are a whole diversity of them, of vulnerabilities, new forms of vulnerability. But psychologically, you can't live in a world where you simply address all the risks we face all the time. You tend to close them off. So what happens when you're a driver, like after an hour or so, your speed starts to resume and you're probably back at the speed you started before. Well, some kind of return to normalcy will happen in the United States and will happen in other countries in the world affected by this, but of course we don't know when, because we don't know the longer term outcome. However, the second factor of this is much more important, and this is what I call the September 10 factor. And I would say most of this lecture and most of my discussions in subsequent lectures are about September 10, not September 11. Meaning by September 10, the world as it was before these events occurred. And the world as it was before these events occurred already had most of the influences, most of the trends, most of the divisions which underlay the attack on September the 11th. To understand what went on September 11th, we must have a structural analysis of what's going on in the world society, and this is what I want to spend the bulk of this lecture talking about. That structural analysis must begin with the impact of living in a more global world. It must begin with the impact of the debate about globalization, because that debate has suddenly become even more urgent for us. There's no doubt that we live in a more interdependent world than anyone has done in previous generations. And there's no doubt that this attack, in some sense, was a version of that interdependence, because a large-scale network stretching across different countries was involved in it. So I want to spend the bulk of this lecture discussing where we stand with the globalization debate, and then at the end come back briefly to the issues I just raised at the beginning. The debate about globalization has gone through two phases. And there have been two phases in the debate about what globalization is and what it means to live in a more globally interdependent world. If you want a definition of globalization, that definition, simplest definition of globalization, is interdependence. Living in a more global world means living in a more interdependent world, where events happening one side of the world in a direct way impact on what's happening at any particular place in the world that one happens to be. Now, the first phase of what David Helders, another professor at the LSE, has called the Great Globalization Debate goes back about 20 years or so. About 20 years ago, this debate started. And the first phase of the Great Globalization Debate was essentially an academic one. It was a discussion about whether globalization exists at all. It was therefore a discussion, in a more profound sense, of how far our world has shifted, or not, over the past 20 or 30 years. Many people doubted that our world today is really very different from the world of 40, 50, or perhaps even 100 years ago. These people came to be known as the globalization skeptics. The globalization skeptics argued that in spite of all the talk of globalization, in spite of all the discussion of the term globalization, not really very much has changed in the world. Globalization skeptics argued that, especially if you look back 100 years to the late 19th century, you find then there was already a very open economic system. There was already then a lot of trade in currencies. There was a lot of physical trade in commodities. Countries had pretty open borders in the late 19th century. There were mass migrations across the world, just as there are mass migrations today. So the globalization skeptics said, what's new? You might be claiming that our world has changed very radically, that we're in a new global age, but this claim is false, they argued, because really not a great deal has changed. At most, what's changed is a kind of reversion to the late 19th century. So that was the first phase of the great globalization debate. And that has been resolved, that phase of the debate has been resolved precisely by the work of David Held, Fred Halliday, and many other authors, quite a few of whom are actually located at the LSE. And these authors have shown, I think, quite definitively, that the globalization skeptics were mainly wrong. That is to say, over the past 30 or so years, the main institutions of global society have shifted dramatically, that although the current phase of globalization, our global age, shares some parallels, has something in common with the late 19th century, the differences are more pronounced than the similarities. You could, if you like, call the late 19th century the first global age, and some people have taken to doing that. That global age was closed down by the advent of the two world wars. You could, and I don't have any objection to this, say we're living in the second global age. Second global age is essentially about 30 or 40 years old, even though it builds on longer term trends, of course. The second global age, however, there's no doubt about it, I think, anymore, is more intensive, it's more comprehensive, it affects everybody in the world, not just parts of the world. It's much more dynamic, it's much more fast moving, and to some extent different institutions are involved from the late 19th century. So the late 20th century, the early 21st century, is definitively not just a replay of what happened before, even though it has certain affinities with it. And it's, of course, the second phase of the great globalization debate that has brought people out into the streets and has created this extraordinary anti-globalization movement, which made its presence felt, first of all, at the meetings of the World Trade Organization in Seattle, but then has expanded in strength through all the different cities at which the WTO, ILF, and other world organizations have met, the most recent being Genoa in Italy, where, as I'm sure you'll remember, there was considerable violence involving the police and demonstrators, and this was true in Gothenburg and has been true quite often in these events. So the second phase of the great globalization debate is no longer just academic. It is immediately political. It involves itself a worldwide movement. And it is something we all have to make sense of. I think as social science students at the LSE, it's incumbent on you to take a position on these things, to work out what's going on, to see whether what the protesters seem to want are things that we should all want or not, and whether or not you have a view of globalization, what's going on in the world, which conforms to mine. The reason why the second, and there's no reason at all why it has to, the second phase of the great globalization debate is terribly, terribly important. It does intersect quite a lot with September 11. It's where September 10 and September 11 come closely together, because it's a debate about the future of the world. It's a debate about what trajectory of development the world will follow and what influence we can, we can and should try to have over that trajectory of development. But I would say when you look at the activities of the protesters and you look at the people they're protesting against, the big world organizations like the IMF, I think you have to say that for them, my view anyway, as for many other people who write about it, globalization is talked about a lot today, but it is poorly understood. It's talked about, but I'm not sure that the people who do talk about it have really grasped, or not all of them, how basic, how fundamental the changes associated with it are. There's one prime reason for this. The prime reason is that most of the people who, so to speak, are for globalization, say like the IMF or World Bank, but also the people who are against it, or in quotes against it, the anti-globalization movement, both sides tend to define globalization essentially as an economic phenomenon, as the expansion of the global marketplace and the increasing role which financial institutions, the world financial system, plays in our lives. If you keep your eyes open, the famous financier George Soros, who is as you probably know, a graduate of the LSE and a supporter of the LSE, has just produced a Soros report on globalization, well worth having a look at. It will come out formally, I think, in about a couple of months' time, and we might be launching it here at the LSE. But Soros, I think, makes the same mistake. That is, Soros defines globalization essentially in terms of the global marketplace as essentially an economic phenomenon. Now, this is obviously not completely a mistake. Obviously not, because if you look at the impact of world financial markets, for instance, and you track back 30 years, which is basically the period I'm calling the global age, the last 30 years or so, you can certainly show that the global financial system has become massively more influential over that period. Now $2 trillion turned over every day on world currency markets, an extraordinary figure, and it was only a fraction of that figure 30 or so years ago. So certainly has been an enormous economic acceleration in terms of the expansion of global trading connections and the impact of global financial systems. It's still pretty regionalized. That is, most trade is not truly globalized, as you could put it. Most trade is still regional. This is not true of currency markets, but most trade in commodities is still regional, so that the European Union, for example, mostly trades with itself. A great deal of the trade of the United States is not external trade. Only about 10%, I think, of the American economy is external trade. So you're talking about regional trade and regional trading blocks. But these things do mark a pretty massive acceleration of global economic interdependence. However, it's crucial to say that globalization is also political, that globalization is also cultural, and it's, to my mind anyway, even more vital to say that globalization is bound up with communications. I think the most important transformative force in our lives over the past 30 or so years is not economic markets, it's not economic interdependence, it is the impact of communications, especially what's normally called the communications revolution. Communications revolution essentially dates from the late 1960s, and that's the time at which the first effective satellite system was sent up above the Earth, making possible instantaneous communication from one side of the world to the other. Once that's happened, then I think so many other things change in the wider world. And what happened along with that is a kind of marriage of communications technology and computerization, the very kind of technological marriage which helped to make financial markets themselves 24-hour trading markets as they've since become. I think it's absolutely vital to stress the impact of communication and the fact that instantaneous communication is the main medium of our increasing interdependence, because it intertwines with almost everything else. Go back to the events of September 11. Those events involved a murder of non-combatants, people who were killed even though there's no claim whatsoever that they were involved in any kind of war situation. Therefore, it was a brutal act by any reckoning. But it was not just an act of murder. What happened on September 11 was clearly an act of global communication. It was experienced as an act of global communication. The people who perpetrated it designed it as an act of global communication. And an enormous proportion of the world watched the second plane crash into the second tower. There was about a 20-minute interval between them. It was a global media event which symbolized something about the kind of communicative interdependence in the world in which we now live. And if you follow what's been going on since then, Osama bin Laden, how did he communicate to the wider world? Well, through the use of videos. A video which described his message and which instantly became news around the world. Osama bin Laden is perhaps most famous, or second or third most famous image in the world today. And that's because of this instantaneous nature of our communication systems. So that's what lies behind so many other changes. And it lies behind the changes that transformed the Soviet Union. I think the Soviet Union could not, its command structure, its economy, could not cope with the kind of fluid world which modern mass communications tends to produce. That then impacts on the economy, because economic change for us very much influenced by the kind of immediacy, the ways in which things are done today. You can't have a static, rigid economy in a world which has itself become much more fluid, dynamic, and fast-moving. So the impact of communications is extraordinary, I think, and is, if you want to single out any single driving force, is the single most important one. But it's just as essential to emphasize that globalization is not a single phenomenon. You have a single term, and therefore people imagine you can be for or against globalization, but globalization refers to a cluster of changes. There are the two I mentioned: economic transformation, transformation of communication systems. The third one is the ending of the Cold War. The ending of the Cold War was partly brought about by these other changes, but also plainly contributed to them. The ending of the Cold War is produced extraordinary changes again in the structure of world society. And if you look what's happening in Afghanistan, or consequences of all that, it's deeply buried in the history of the Cold War, where the Soviets and the US fought out the Cold War in Afghanistan and other parts of the world. So we're still very much experiencing what it means to live in a world which is no longer a bipolar world. It's because globalization is such a complex thing, it's like a shorthand term for a complex of changes, that you have to be very careful saying you're either against it or for it. It's much more important to specify which aspects of these changes you're for and against. You can be for and against, for example, certain versions of free trade, but that is not at all the same as being for or against globalization, not in my view. It's also very important to recognize that because it's a complicated set of changes subsumed under a single term, there is not a single set of consequences. So if globalization undoubtedly alters the powers of the nation, which I'll be talking about in the next lecture next week, but at the same time, it is globalization that is responsible for the increasing importance of regionalism, the increasing importance of local nationalism, the increasing importance of decentralization and devolution of power in our lives. Look what's happening in the UK. You have devolution of power to Scotland, devolution of power to Wales, and further devolution will almost certainly follow. Well, that devolution has been around a long time because there have been Scottish nationalists around a long time, for example. But the fact that it's happened now is structurally related to the impact of what globalization does. Globalization, because it pulls some powers away from the nation, it also pushes down, it forces decentralization of power away from national government. The sociologist Daniel Bell had perhaps the most celebrated quote about this that anyone's made, when he said the nation state has become too small to solve the big problems and too big to solve the small problems. That's quite a good way of expressing this kind of push and pull, really, which globalization brings about. Don't make the mistake of supposing that globalization is purely an external force. So many people talk about globalization in this way. So many people talk about the impact of globalization on us as though it's simply an external force somewhere in the world impacting on us. If we're in a poor country or a rich country, doesn't matter, it's some kind of simply external thing. It is not like that. Globalization is something produced by people in their everyday lives. It's produced asymmetrically because it does not, of course, create an egalitarian world. But every time anyone here gets into the LSE website or turns on a computer or uses the internet, you're not just responding to globalization, you are an agent of globalizing processes because you're participating in these very processes that are helping to reshape the world. This is not just a phenomenon of the rich nations, no matter how much the rich nations tend to lead the way and tend to dominate. Every time a poor person in Zambia switches on the radio and listens to the World Service or listens to any kind of radio broadcasting, they are participating in wider globalizing processes, not just experiencing them. So globalization is, as it were, a dialectical phenomenon. This goes back to the issue of agency that Fred mentioned in the beginning. We are agents of this process at the same time as we are affected by it, and our lives are thoroughly transformed by it, really. So in sum, I would define globalization as a shift in the basic institutions of world society. That is therefore the theme of the rest of the lectures in this course, ranging all the way through, I think anyway, from the family, personal life, where you see massive structural shifts across the world in the family, right the way through the nature of economic life, the nature of political sovereignty, of cultural life, and the wider global society with the world institutions that I referred to earlier. Tremendous package of change. Really, really difficult for any of us to adjust to, whether it's emotionally, personally, or on the level of academic analysis. But as academic analysts, we must lead the way in trying to show what this world is like and what implications it has for us. Now, if you go back to the protest movements, what should we make of the anti-globalization movement, its objectives, and its likely impact on us? Well, the first thing one has to say about this is that the anti-globalization movement, for the reasons I mentioned just now, does not stand outside globalization. You might think that because you're against globalization, you're somehow outside those processes, but this is manifestly not the case. The anti-globalization movement, much more accurate to see it as part and parcel of globalizing processes, because as we know, the people who assembled on the streets made use of new communications technologies, they used the internet, they used the whole range of mobile phones and other communicative technologies which define a large amount of what globalization was about. And of course they carried their message globally. The protesters on the streets were not just protesting locally, they were protesting globally, and of course they knew and used the fact that the image of their protest was immediately carried around the world. So what happened in Seattle was, again, like what happened in New York and Washington, a global event, global consequences. You're talking here, if you like, about two sides of globalization, not people who are outside and people who are inside. The two sides of globalization are globalization from above, essentially led by the political policies of nations, so for example, deregulation policies, by the activities of corporations and other agents connected with them. Globalization from below is especially influenced by the activities of non-governmental associations or NGOs and other civil society groups. Globalization from below is again just as important to understanding what globalization is, because you have a tremendous acceleration in the numbers of NGOs working in the world and their global purchase. People say the big corporations have a global purchase. Well, so do the big NGOs, Oxfam, Greenpeace, so forth. These are truly global organizations. There are now, at the latest estimate, 30,000 NGOs working in the world. There are only a few hundred, again, 30 or so years ago. So you have two aspects, or two institutional versions, if you like, of global interdependence kind of interacting one another around the protest movement. Now, what are the people protesting about? Should we be sympathetic to the protests which the anti-globalization movement is making? We know that the people on the streets are very diverse, so there is not a single set of objectives which the anti-globalization movement holds. There are quite a lot of groups with wildly different objectives. For example, some far-left groups involved in the anti-globalization movement in some sort of way want to overthrow capitalism as an economic system, even though no one knows any alternative at the moment to that system. But the majority of protesters, I would say, are peaceful. The majority of protesters actually come from the NGO sector. NGO is very prominently represented in all the anti-globalization marches, protest movements, do not intend violence, and I think carry a serious message to us. What are they protesting about? Well, there are three things, I think, mainly, among the more sober side, as it were, of the anti-globalization movement, and all of them must concern all of us, whether we sympathize with the activities of the anti-globalization movement or not. The first claim they are making is that globalization is essentially a Western phenomenon, that it's dominated by the interests of the West, and especially by the interests of the United States, that the rest of the world does not really get a look in, so that globalization is essentially a project for one-fifth of the world, from which four-fifths of the world are excluded. In my view, that is not at all a correct presumption, but it is something that must be addressed, because there are major imbalances of power in the emerging global society, as there were in the old Cold War period, and those imbalances of power cannot really be tolerated, or should not be tolerated, if we try and build a more just and equal society on a global level. So we have to come back to that in subsequent discussions. Second, they're saying that corporations have too much influence, that because of the impact of market-led philosophies, economic deregulation, the corporations who are unelected, the big business corporations, have too much power, not only in developing parts of the world, but also in our own lives too, the protesters are saying. Who elects the big corporations? Nobody. Yet the big corporations seem to take many decisions which should belong in the public sphere, the sphere of democratic politics, where all of us can give voice to our interests and discuss policy questions. I think this argument also must be listened to. A good society is not a society which is dominated by the interests of the marketplace. A good society is not a society where corporate power becomes too big and where corporations can illegitimately affect democratic decision making. A society where markets invade too much of our lives is unstable, it's erratic, it's too unequal. A society where markets invade too much of our lives becomes too commercialized. Values which we should stand for in areas of our life, for example in health, education, or in the civic goods of city neighborhoods, we mustn't allow those to become too commercialized, because commercialization, not inevitably, but can be the enemy of other values which I believe as civic-minded citizens we should support. We mustn't assume that consumer power is the same as citizenship. We mustn't assume that the right to roam the aisles of a supermarket is the same as citizenship rights within a democratic polity, within a democratic society. There is a retrieval of public space which needs to be pursued. And that's again an issue which I'll come back to subsequently. Finally, thirdly, the protesters are saying there's too much inequality in the world, that globalization is a product, as a project, not only of the advanced sectors of the world, but of the rich countries. The rich countries are pursuing their interests at the expense of the poor countries. The developing world is largely excluded, and the protesters are arguing globalization is producing a world which is riven with inequalities between rich and poor, and that's why we should seek to reverse it. That's why we should seek to put the clock back. That's also an issue I'll be talking about directly in the third lecture of this series. These are all serious, serious questions. I don't agree myself with some of the views of some of the protesters, but these are all questions which we have to analyze out, and I'll try to do so in subsequent discussions. So I'll now turn to Fred, who's going to interrogate me briefly, and then if you can manage to stay at least until just before two, have one or two questions from the floor. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Tom.
You want to sit down or do you want to stand up?
Stand up.
Well, one of the first things, don't interrogate your boss, but I'll give it a try. Tony, I very much like the point you made that we should think of 10th of September as well as 11th of September in terms of the ongoing problems, global inequality. There's a very good piece in today's Financial Times by Martin Wolf making this point that the developed world, he said, is like people in a stretched limo driving with some security through a poor area, but actually that stretched limo is not protected from what they see through the window, and the window has been broken on the 11th of September, but that situation was there anyway. I think it also pertains to a question which should be asked more, is when did this war start? Did it start on the 7th of October with the bombing of Afghanistan? Did it start on the 11th of September? Or did it, as bin Laden himself say, start many years ago, 80 years ago in his argument? In other words, the conflict itself did not begin on the 11th of September on either side, and you can think back to military operations in the 90s. I wanted to ask you about two things.
Speaking
though.
Speaking in a mic, though.
Well, two things. Speaking, wearing my international relations hat, without security, there can be no globalization. And I think that the illusion, the 10th of September illusion, is that security of the high seas, security of citizens, security of property, peace in the world was largely taken care of, and we could get on with the rest of the globalization agenda, which was a liberal internationalist agenda. Trade, migration, higher education, and so forth. Don't you think that in a way we have to look more carefully at the security underpinnings of globalization, of all the other things we're talking about, starting with something which we're all concerned about, which is travel, which has suddenly become more insecure? I was in my local Sainsbury's the other day. There were some Russians there trying to buy English cheese, cheddar. What this cheddar 3? What this cheddar 5? Anyway, I got talking to them. They were lawyers. And I said, what do you think of British lawyers? And they said, very mediocre people. And I said, why? He said, they have not read Hobbes. They have not read Thomas Hobbes. In other words, they've forgotten issues of international security. And I'd like to know whether you think your own vision of globalization and the problems can take on board the security issues, and equally the question of who is going to do the security, because it ain't going to be global civil society. It ain't going to be the MNCs. It ain't going to be the LSE. It's got to be, unless I've got it wrong, it's got to be states and the bigger, tougher states at that. And that's an old-fashioned problem. Second,
now, shall I respond to that? I'll respond to that first of all and then come to your second one. I mean, I think there's a serious element to that, and I hope the LSE actually can contribute, because I think for security you need a cosmopolitan world, you need people who are able to express cosmopolitan values. You need people who are able to lead the world onwards. And I think this is what the LSE helps do. And I think the very existence of the LSE is, you see so many people from so many different countries sitting here, it's already a kind of expression of that cosmopolitanism. No, I mean, beyond that, providing security is a difficult business, but it seems to me, and I think you agree, at least to some degree, that the structure of international relations has changed over the period that we're talking about. So although there are still areas of the world where traditional wars between nations are not implausible, and those include, unfortunately, between India and Pakistan, or between Taiwan and mainland China, the Far East, where you have real tensions and you have nuclear powers involved there. But for the most part, the structure of violence does seem to be changing, and it seems to be changing in these connected ways towards the existence of, or the problem of preventing bitter, local, intense, often ethnic or religiously based conflicts of the kind we saw in ex-Yugoslavia or in other different parts of the world. Extremely hard to manage. Once they start, very hard to manage their implications, because they affect our security, as you were hinting. They're local, but they're much more international than traditional wars, perversely. And Mary Calder at the LSE and Fred himself have written very instructively about these issues. So that can join with new networks of violence. I mean, it was plain that globalization can produce new networks of violence. I just read on the book coming back from the US, I just got back from the US 2 days ago, and was raising funds for everyone at the LSE. I was reading this book that I recommend to you by Robert J. Lipton on the Japanese religious sect which released the gas in the Japanese subway, where he has a kind of analysis of very similar structure to different fundamentalist movements around the world. They have involved quite similar features: existence of a guru, existence of a clear division between black and white or good and bad, the recruitment of usually very quite young men, often marginalized men, to the movement. These are things which we do need to think of new ways of creating security against these, and they won't be the old ways, I think. But my belief is that we are in an interdependent world. You can't actually reverse some aspects of globalization. You could reverse liberalization of trade, but I think that would be a mistake. What you need to do is equalize the playing field for trade, not reverse it. But I don't think we can reverse our new interdependence. Therefore, I feel we must find ways of dealing with these security issues, and that'll probably mean new strategies from the past.
Your distinguished predecessor, Sir Halford Mackinder, believed that the role of the LSE was to promote a world empire. That's what
Who was he then?
He was the second director of the LSE.
Just kidding you, I mean, the audience don't know.
And a truly terrible joke, but you'll all remember it. His name was Mackinder, and he thought that the LSE should train people for the empire, and it should be, wait for it, the Mackinder Garden of the British Empire. Yeah. My second and last question is this. You talked about global civil society. I sense, and I sometimes feel it reading what you write and Mary Calder and David Held writes, that you have too angelic a view, too trusting a view of civil society. You don't ask enough the question, what are the responsibilities of civil society? To whom are NGOs responsible? To what extent are they posing realistic alternatives? To what extent don't you have intolerant, illiberal, fundamentalist, anti-feminist, all sorts of other groups as part of civil society? So giving more space to civil society, yes, in the domestic and international debate, but can we not hold them accountable to liberal international values as well? Because many of them are not. Many of them are quite nasty and illiberal people. Many of them are manipulated by states or even by mafia groups and so on. Don't you think more attention has to, we can't just open the world up to civil society because there's a lot of nasty people out there as well.
You want to hear some answers to these questions. This is not staged, I assure you. I didn't know I was going to ask, but you want to hear some answers to these questions, come and hear the major thinker Ulrich Beck, who comes to the LSE next term and always gives a couple of public lectures where he makes precisely these points. I don't write about civil society in the same way as Mary Calder and David Held does, but civil society produces what Ulrich Beck calls ugly citizens. Ugly citizens are people who take advantage of democratic rights and procedures. And the growth of civil society produces diversity of ugly citizens. For example, right-wing, extreme right groups who use the internet to promote their cause. So there's no way you can say that civil society is a purely benign force. It's quite right to say that, I think. And the issue of democratic rights is a real one. I do agree with you on that. NGOs are no more elected than the big corporations are. Therefore, you couldn't substitute for orthodox democratic politics a world which is run too much by NGOs. One major reason for this is that NGOs represent different groups, some of them nasty, as we said, but NGOs are also special interest groups. Somebody has to reconcile the different claims of these different interest groups, and the only way of reconciling that is through democratic governments. Therefore, democratic government must still, and citizenship within democratic political systems, must still remain the core of how you address those issues. Shall we just have one or two quick questions from the audience? I don't know if anyone wants to ask any, but it makes it a bit more participatory. Well, I think you do need to use a mic, though. There's a microphone around somewhere.
Yeah. Antonis Hadjigiriagou, postgraduate student from Birkbeck.
What are you doing here, then? What are you doing here if you're from Birkbeck? Should be the LSE.
It's a globalizing phenomenon.
Well said.
I completely agree with you that the question is not whether we are being globalized or not, is to identify the processes of globalization. And it is a very complex and complicated phenomenon, but it seems to me that you are assuming a universal, united experience of globalization. As you've said, there are loads of agents within the globalization process which experience globalization in a different way and affect globalization differently. And surely I don't think that our experience of globalization here in this lecture theater is the same as a person who is in Zambia turning on the radio.
Okay, well, thanks. No, that's clear. There must be poor communication on my part, because I had tried to say that is indeed the case. So you must unpack the term globalization, because that's why it makes no sense to say you're for it or against it. Globalization means a whole package of changes, many of them concentrated in the last 30 or so years, affecting different people in different parts of the world very differently, sometimes accentuating the differences between them, for example, sometimes accentuating differences between rich and poor, other times producing the opposite, because we know, for example, that in East Asia, countries have got much richer than they were before. We know there's not a universal process of exclusion going on here, so it's quite right to say you're talking not of a single process, but highly differentiated one with different causal origins, different consequences, affecting different people differently in different parts of the world. But there's an important sense in which no one is outside any longer. Your peasant in Zambia is inside the system, much more than was ever true in the past. Therefore, for example, don't know how many people here might be from Argentina, but what happens to the Argentinian economy, whether we like it or not, is going to affect all of us in the richer or the poorer countries. No response from you, please. Could we have one more question? Do you want to take this mic and hand it back?
Talking in Cardiff recently about the fundamentalist threat to our brackets, globalised world today, Tony Blair talked about people hating our decadent society. How would you define a decadent society? Do we have one, and is that a bad thing if we're in one?
Well, that's a pretty neat question, I think. I mean, no, I don't think we do have a decadent society. I think in the UK we have a pretty well-established democratic system which has remained intact for a longer period than the democratic system of most Western countries, which have been interrupted by periods of fascism in many other, even within the EU states, that's true, and which permits tolerance, openness, and permits exchange of information on these kinds of issues openly. Those things are part of Western values, which I think are universalizable values. You know, I think democracy, openness of debate, those universalizable things. But that's not the same as to say that our society is a society which answers questions of values and ethics satisfactorily, because I would tend to say in some respects it doesn't. I wouldn't use the term decadent because it's such a culturally loaded term, but there are ethical spaces in our society, I think, which need to be filled. Some of those are in the political sphere and some are in the personal sphere. If, for example, I mean, when I come to talk about marriage and the family and sexuality, if you can't sort of reinfuse the space of our lives with an ethics of relationships, then there are serious problems, I think, moral problems in people's personal lives. But the answer surely is not a retreat to fundamentalism. The answer is surely not a belief system which is so rigid that it doesn't allow any of these things. You know, you can't have any open discussion. That is not the answer. So you have to build on democratic dialogue, and I think this country and quite a few countries in the world, there has been an expansion of democracy. That's universalizable value. That is not decadent at all. Well, thanks very much for coming, everybody. I hope that you might come again next week.